Busy show back with you on Tuesday, March 16th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. There was a gathering on this day of a few hundred people at the state capitol protesting against a possible move to get rid of the religious exemption for folks who don't want their kids vaccinated. In Connecticut, we spoke to Dr. Matt Paterna, local member of a group that wants the exemption to stay. Also during the show, I added some thoughts regarding a now growing problem at the southern border with illegal immigration, and we heard from a couple of callers regarding a growing controversy now as to whether or not state legislative Democrats will bigfoot some local zoning regulations because they think some of these regulations, especially in suburban towns and in Fairfield County, are inherently racist in nature. You know, there's some things in life, in politics, life, business, whatever, that you watch happen and you sit back and you say, well, no wonder that happened. And sometimes you sit back and you giggle at people who are at least, I don't know, are they sincere? I don't know. Are they trying to put a little verbal bob and weave or dip and dive on some of these things to make it sound like they're really a lot dumber than they really are? What am I talking about? Well, you heard the news there at the top of the hour. Hopefully you did. Listen, it's all hands on deck now with what's going on at the southwest border. Now, the White House doesn't want to talk about this. It's clear they don't want to talk about this. In fact, you know, there are some congressional Democrats, and this is no secret. This has been, this has been being written about on these political blogs for a couple of weeks now. And I am sure that if you pulled any one of the seven Democrats, the five House members, or our two Senate members aside, Mr. Blumenthal and Mr. Murphy, if you put them aside and ask them off the record, are you concerned about this from a political point of view, you're damn sure they're going to say they are. I mean, there are already Democrats saying, hey, this is going to kill us in the midterms. What am I talking about? Well, the situation at the southern border. And I know the president and the vice president are out there touting this $1.9 trillion reinvestment plan after COVID. That's great. That's great. But the bill is passed. It's law now. And I know all presidents do this, but this is a waste of time. You know, and of course, Mr. Biden and Ms. Harris are in Pennsylvania. Of course, that's a big swing state. Don't forget, there's going to be a Senate seat up there. So you watch where they go to push this stuff. They don't really go a lot of times to solid blue states. They're already looking at the 2022 midterms. But something that, you know, Jen Psaki, Connecticut native, and a lot of folks always tap dance around the White House now is, what the hell is going on at the southern border? And you may say, well, Paul, we're way up here in Connecticut. Yeah, but we also have 120,000 by an estimate illegals here. And who knows how many of the folks crossing now are going to end up here in Connecticut. You don't know. So it's not hard to find this story. I'm looking at NBCNews.com right now. Get this. Get this. Southwest border crossings on pace for the highest level in 20 years. Biden administration says. So that's not coming from some far right-wing group. That's coming from the White House. Now, border agents. Now, let's break this down a little bit, shall we, at 212 on a Tuesday. Border agents are encountering, now get this, 565 unaccompanied migrant kids crossing the border on average per day. Up from 313 kids a day last month. I'll read that again. Border agents are encountering 565 unaccompanied migrant children crossing the border on average per day, up from 313 a day last month. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas saying, quote, we are on pace to encounter more individuals on the southwest border than we have in the last 20 years. We are expelling most single adults and families. We are not expelling unaccompanied kids. Now, here's my question. Well, here's the point I was making. Why do you think this is happening? Why do you think this is happening? Why? Why do you think this is happening? Well, because one candidate, one party, basically telegraphed this before the election. I'm chatting with some folks on Facebook last night, and one person I know goes, geez, this is just horrible. Why is this happening? And me and a bunch of folks are going, why is it happening? Did you follow the campaign at all leading up to Election Day? When you go out there saying, well, we're going to dismantle everything the Trump White House did, of course they're going to line up like crazy. Now, Mr. Mayorkas went on to say, quote, our goal is a safe, legal, and orderly immigration system that is based on our bedrock priorities to keep the borders secure, yeah, address the plight of kids as the law requires, and enable families to be together. The surge has created a backlog in Border Patrol stations, with over 4,200 kids in custody and almost 3,000 being held over the 72-hour legal limit. The new figures are a record high, topping last week, where there were roughly 3,000 kids in custody, 1,400 of whom who were held over the 72-hour limit. Now, look, you can slice and dice this any way you want. Kids, what are they in? Are they in tents? Are they in this Border Patrol facilities? Listen, here's what we really have to face here. And I'm sure inside the White House and inside the halls of Congress and inside DHS facilities, they know this. But there are forces in Mexico, in South America. I don't know who it is. I have no idea how these kids get here. Who sends them over? Are they trafficking? Are their parents paying for this? I don't know. Is this some sort of twisted way to give your kids a better life than you have? Maybe you're just telling them, listen, get out. It'll be better in America, and we'll come for you. Knock, knock, wink, wink. I don't know. But the bottom line is somebody is doing this to overrun and overwhelm our border forces. They know how our system works. They know what areas are protected by a fence. They know what areas are not protected by a fence. They know how to game the asylum system. And apparently somebody is doing this with unaccompanied kids as bait. Hello, where's the UN? Where are these countries? I mean, do we know who's doing this? I'm sure we do. But everybody's saying now, well, this is happening because we're undoing what the Trump White House did. Well, they weren't coming here. Apparently, if these numbers, if they weren't coming here in these numbers in the Trump years as they are now, is that such a bad thing? FEMA is quickly building decompression centers in Dallas and Midland, Texas, to allow Health and Human Services, the agency equipped to care for kids before they're placed with sponsors, to take more children out of Border Patrol custody. I mean, what's the end game here? Is this? I'm serious. I don't get this. What's the end game here? Unaccompanied kids. Mayorkas explained the majority of the people apprehended at the southwest border are single adults, and they're currently being expelled under CDC authority to manage a health crisis during the COVID-19 pandemic. Single adults from Mexico and the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras are swiftly expelled to Mexico. Similarly, families apprehended at the border who came from Mexico or those other countries are being expelled to Mexico, quote, unless Mexico does not have the capacity to receive the families. Oh, folks, I'm telling you, and I understand the plight of some of these people. You're not going to tell me this is all genuine. You're not. There's a push here to overwhelm our facilities, the already overwhelmed asylum system. And I'm sorry, but the new people that are running things, at least to me, they don't have the guts. They don't have the julions to call this what it is. I'm sorry. Does this happen anywhere else in the world? Honestly. And that's a serious question. Does this happen anywhere else on the globe where there's just this constant 400 today, 500 yesterday? Where else is there was this allowed to happen? How or when do we have the capacity to say, listen, we feel bad for people, but enough? No, you cannot come in here. And who in the hell is sending unaccompanied kids here? They know. A lot of people know, and they just don't want to do it. They don't want to bite the bullet and say, enough of this, stop. You know what we got to do? We got to do what the former guy in the Oval Office did. You know, sometimes you got to threaten, you want to lose those foreign aid dollars? Well, keep doing what you're doing. Earlier today at the Connecticut State Capitol, a bunch of folks got together to voice their opinion on something that actually, folks, we've been talking about on this show for over a year. If you remember, previous to COVID, we had that measles outbreak in Westchester County, not too far from where we are. And then immediately once that was controlled, there began a push in the General Assembly from some members there to eliminate an exemption Connecticut has to get kids vaccinated to enter public school if it was opposed on religious grounds. And at last look, I looked at the figures myself last week, about 8,000 kids either were entering or are entering school without having any or full vaccinations. The vast, vast, vast majority still do. However, there is a bill in advancing in the General Assembly that would get rid of these religious exemptions. You would only be left with, I believe, a medical exemption if you're immunocompromised. So the big story is, what happens to these kids, number one? Where would they go to school if their parents don't fully immunize them? And number two, to what length does a government have the right to enforce a law that says somebody has to put something in their child's body? Whether you agree with it or not, it's a very interesting conundrum. One of the groups that took advantage today in Hartford is Health Choice for Action Connecticut, ct4action.org. And joining us right now, he was part of the group today to give us his opinion on this whole thing, is Dr. Matt Paterna. He's with us. He's a member of this group. Dr. Paterna, hi. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Paul, I'm terrific. How are you?
I'm good. So, Dr. Paterna, I'm sure you've heard this, but let's call this for what it is. I'm sure, maybe you don't, but knowing people the way they are, I'm guessing you may hear, oh, what's wrong with you people? Just get the vaccine. Come on, get with it. It's 2021. The heck with this exemption thing. Do you hear a lot of that? And if you do, doctor, what's your response to that?
Well, yeah, of course we hear that. I mean, I hear that from my friends and some family members as well. My response to that is that, bottom line, when you're talking about putting a medical product in your body, you should have a choice as to what goes into your body, and it should never be about being forced or coerced to do so.
So that does, I think, lend itself to one aspect of this, doctor, away from the epidemiological aspect. I've always tried to explain people there is another aspect to this, that a government, be it a state government here in Connecticut, is basically telling parents and guardians, if you want to take advantage, if your kids want to, of the taxpayer-based public, and it's some private schools too, public education, yep, you must put something in your child's body that maybe you don't agree with.
That's correct. And this applies to both public, private schools, camps, colleges, mm-hmm, daycares. I mean, it basically affects just about everybody who's you know, in school. So it doesn't just affect the public school kids.
Is your opposition to this, doctor, and your desire to maintain the religious exemption for these kids and these parents, is it based on a freedom aspect, a governmental aspect, a medical aspect, an epidemiological aspect? How would you categorize that in your own thinking?
Well, I mean, most of us are fighting for the religious exemption. So we're fighting for our right to maintain our belief that we have the choice as to what goes into our children's bodies. So many of us object to putting foreign substances or vaccines into our children. Just recently, the Archdiocese of New Orleans denounced certain vaccines because of the presence of aborted fetal tissue fragments in the preparation of the vaccine. So there are many reasons why people would choose to take a religious exemption. In the state of Connecticut, and actually in our Constitution, our United States Constitution, religion is defined as your personal creed. So even though people will say it's not part of the Christian or Catholic or Jewish religion to be against vaccination, individuals can have the right to interpret their religions the way that they want to. And a good example is, are you Catholic, Paul?
Oh, yes. Guilt, for full Catholic guilt, yes. Oh, absolutely, yes.
as am I. But yeah. As a Catholic, I don't object to homosexual marriage. Because that's just the choice that I've made, you know. Mm-hmm. So I also believe that a woman should have a right to choose if she wants to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm pro-abortion, but I also don't think that I should be telling someone what they should or should not do with their body. So these are kind of examples of, you know, it doesn't have to be necessarily part of the organized religion belief. This is your personal creed. And I would love to remind your viewers that the United States was founded on this very principle. People risked their lives and traveled on rickety boats across a body of water to flee from religious persecution, you know, a couple hundred years mm-hmm. ago. And that's what we based our country on, and that's what the First Amendment really focuses on, is our right to free speech and our right to religion.
Dr. Matt Paterna is the guest. He took part today in a demonstration and a push to keep the religious exemption in place here in Connecticut, currently used by about 8,000 kids or families to not have mandatory vaccines, dictate as to whether those kids could get into private and or public schools or universities. Dr. Paterna, hang on, please. We'll be right back with you. More with Dr. Matt Paterna and this very emotional issue. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And I would bet you a whole lot that Seymour parents and guardians and all over the place here, Fairfield County, New Haven County, all over Connecticut, this is a talkable. This is one of those issues that stimulates conversation, whether or not in the wake of COVID-19 and in the wake of before that a measles outbreak in Westchester County back a year and a half ago, whether Connecticut should keep or get rid of what's called a medical exemption, where parents or guardians can say, because of religious exemption, they can say that, hey, because of my religion or my religious beliefs, we should not mandate that our kids be vaccinated before they get into schools. Dr. Matt Paterna of Health Choice for Action Connecticut was involved today at the Capitol. Dr. Paterna, back with you. So what did happen up there? I know you had some speakers. Did you get any contact at all with any legislators either today or in, you know, previous weeks talking about this as it was hotly debated a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, today we had several legislators come out in support of our cause. We had over 500 people outside today. It was a little chilly, so we, you know, it probably kept the numbers down just a bit, but we still had a fantastic showing. Well, yes, we had a lot of legislative support. Most of the support that we're getting is coming from the conservative side. This has become a partisan issue, and we're getting most of the support from the Republican side right now. But there are some Democrats who are also sympathetic. I think the challenge that they're going to have is to really decide whether or not it's prudent to throw 8,000 to 10,000 children out of school, especially in the light of the fact that there's been no measles outbreak in the state of Connecticut to date. And mm-hmm. there's never been an instance where a child has started an outbreak in a school system. And I think that that's really what they're trying to push this on. They're using the outbreak in New York, as you mentioned,
yeah,
at the start of the segment, But keep in mind that that outbreak in New York was a contained outbreak in a religious community. And it was much, much similar to, remember when we were kids, Paul, and we got the chicken pox, and you know we got it from our neighbor. Did you do that?
I you know what? My mom said she thinks I had a mild case of it once. I don't remember, but yeah, before widespread vaccinations, that's what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's basically what it was. So this was in a highly religious Hasidic community, and it's a rite of passage for them. And it was very contained. As a matter of fact, the state of Connecticut did a marvelous job in making sure that the containment stayed on that side of the border. And, you know, we have such great public health policy in place. And even now after COVID, you know, we saw it in place now. We've got a pandemic occurring in our state, and yet you don't hear about any real issues in the school systems, right? You don't hear about kids getting sick. You don't hear about teachers getting sick on a large scale. I think that we've done a really good job. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, prior to vaccination, you know, keep in mind why we have a vaccination program, because back when we didn't have, you know, proper treatment for things like measles, mumps, and rubella, or pertussis, we didn't also have things like proper sanitation and plumbing and, you know, potable water and good nutrition. We live in a very different time now. So, you know, the instances of these issues are extremely rare. So for our group, you know, and to your listeners, you really have to ask yourself, you know, is it necessary to throw 8,000 to 10,000 children out of school just to appease a number that they're trying to stay above? They like to talk about this herd immunity number, this 95%. And if you do some research on that 95%, it really doesn't exist anywhere in research. It's more of a goal. Mm-hmm. And I can be happy to say that that Connecticut has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country.
I did read that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing great. So we're basically persecuting a very small percentage of students. We're talking about 1.5%.
So the legislators pushing this, Dr. Paterna, would you categorize this, in your opinion, both ethically and medically? Do you think this is just an overreaction to a problem that doesn't really exist?
This is a classic example of fixing a problem that does not exist. Correct. I agree with that.
Where do you think, finally, where does this all go? You said you've spoke to legislators, and in my decades covering politics, doctor, you know, a lot of these things, you know, it's good fodder for legislators to grandstand on both sides of the aisle. They can hold a public hearing. It doesn't mean this is coming up for a vote. I have been told by my contacts in Hartford that this is one of those things that may be a little too much of a hot potato, because think about this. Connecticut's a relatively small state. 8,000 kids times two parents. You know, you're talking about 16,000, maybe even more votes. And in a state like Connecticut, 16,000, 15,000, 16,000, 20,000 votes, that can shift elections or an election.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of what they're starting to realize, is that we do have a large group of people. As a matter of fact, between the four groups that are in the state for parental rights, we've got over 20,000 members. So there are people that still fully vaccinate their kids, but they're very much on board with this. Because here's what's at stake for your listeners, is that if they remove the religious exemption, let's just say hypothetically that they wanted to add COVID as a mandatory shot for school.
Yeah.
How many parents would be excited about that idea? I would think many would not be, because it's still a relatively new vaccine. It's still experimental. It hasn't been approved by the FDA yet.
In fact, they're just putting out the call, I think, doctor, today and yesterday. You probably saw this, to start the trials in kids.
Exactly. So I think that's something that people have to understand. And then again, there's always the risk. You know, we have the United States has paid out over $4.5 billion in injuries to families and individuals who've been injured by vaccinations over the past 30 years. So there is a risk when we talk about vaccination. So if we're going to mandate a product that has no liability, and again, I don't know if many of your listeners know this, but you know, if you're injured by any vaccine, COVID or any of the other vaccines, you have no recourse. You do not. You have no recourse. There is a program that the government has, and as I mentioned, they paid out over $4.5 billion. But that represents less than 10% of the cases that ever get reported. Mm-hmm. And to actually get any money from that system, it's a very difficult thing to do. And yet they still paid out that amount. So, you know, when people say, hey, it's safe, just do it, you know, get with the times, as you mentioned earlier, you know, people have a fundamental duty mm-hmm. to protect their children, right?
I think
I think it's the number one job of any parent is to protect their own child. And listen, I understand the idea of, you know, community immunity and doing what's right for the community. Listen, if my kids are sick, I'm keeping them home. If they're sniffling, I'm keeping them home. Yeah. We make sure our children are healthy. We don't do this. We don't choose to do this without doing our proper due diligence and our research. And I can tell you that most of the people in our community are very much the same way. Mm-hmm. We're very understanding of what the situation is, and we take the precautions necessary to keep our children healthy and keep them home when they're not feeling well.
Yeah, basic common sense. Dr. Matt Paterna, the group Health Choice for Action, Connecticut, online at CT4Action.org. CT4Action.org. Well, we'll see how this whole thing shakes out. Dr. Paterna, thank you so much. We appreciate it. And have a happy day, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Paul, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Matt Paterna. All right, folks, it's a tough issue. It's, again, you may be on the, you know, the side of, listen, just get with the times. It's 2021. But as Dr. Paterna said, if this passes, 8,000 kids, if you go by the numbers today as we speak on this March 16th on WICC, 8,000 kids won't be allowed to go to school. Greg in Oxford. Hey, Greg, you're on WICC. What's up?
Hey, Paul. How you doing? Yeah, earlier you were talking about the affordable housing, and I used to be on the planning board. Basically, I think what it is that they have to keep 80% of the, like, say, for example, if it's apartments, mm-hmm. affordable housing. And what happened up here is a couple of these deals were approved, but the thing is, if they can't fill up that 80%, they can't build any more housing. Because what happens is a lot of the builders want to fill up that affordable portion so they can build more. And that didn't happen up here.
So, Greg, answer me, and I'm so glad you called in because you're talking from experience, and I love this. Who determines, are there limits or regulations as to what exactly those units can either sell for or rent for? How do you determine, how is that determined, Greg?
The attorneys for the people that were building the house, they had documents that were from, I think, the state of Connecticut, which limited them. I don't know what the prices were that said they had this was the price they had to charge for it to be affordable housing. And what happened here was not that the community was really against, you know, affordable housing or anything, but what happens is they came in with one plan, and then when we knocked it down, then they hold the affordable housing sword over you.
Okay.
Then they say, okay, we're going to do affordable housing in 80%. Now, in this community, what happened is, like I said, they had other affordable housing that wasn't filled. So they couldn't really, I don't think they were able to use that argument or that threat as much as they probably could in other communities.
Interesting. So Greg, if let's just say, not necessarily Oxford, but let's just say your community or another one. So if a unit, and I'm just trying to get a better grasp on this. Let's say a unit in non-affordable housing in a town, a rental, is, I don't know, let's make it round figure, $1,000 a month for a one bedroom. Normally, under an affordable housing price, what would that be? $500, $600? Is that what the state would dictate?
I would say I would say somewhere around there. And the builders would still make a profit, but they wouldn't make as much of a profit. And then the other 80% would be on what the demand could take. You know what I'm saying? What they would take on that. But it's a big game, and it's a shame that it has to be a game like that. But the builders are all in for that. And there was plenty of property, too, that we said, well, why don't you use it like when you're talking about putting them in one-family areas and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We had a lot of area here where they could have built it with no problem, and because it wasn't in a one-family area.
Yeah.
But they didn't want that. They didn't want that. So it's a big game, and it's a shame because the people that need the housing, and this is one of the things that really opened up my eyes, one of the attorneys for the people that were building it, and he was right. He took the town payroll records, and he went ahead and said all of these people that are working for the town would qualify for affordable housing based on their income. Which I thought was a smart thing, but it was also an eye opener because then there was a demand for affordable housing. But it is a sad game though that these builders play, on some of these communities.
And that tells me what you just told me, Greg, about town employees who would qualify under affordable housing. I don't think it's so much an indictment of Oxford or any other town as to what they pay. I think it's more of an indictment as to some of these housing costs, Greg, that are out there. I mean, listen, we're in the Northeast. It's a high-dollar area. I get it. But again, like I said the other day, I looked it up, and, the average apartment in Connecticut is almost $1,300 a month. I mean, that's insane
We have a brand new apartment complex which is in the shopping center, and the builder, he's an excellent, he does excellent work, and I think the community needed that type of shopping center.
Yeah.
But he also built apartments with it, and I heard that these beautiful apartments are going for $1,800 to over $2,000 a month.
Now, who can afford? I can't afford. Who can afford that?
Well, I could probably afford it, but I wouldn't want to pay that.
Well, and again. Greg, thank you. I really appreciate it. Greg in Oxford there, who was in the middle of all this. Greg, thank you. Much appreciated. So as I suspected, and Greg straightened me out on that, there would be, I guess it would be state or looking at law saying, okay, this is a maximum rent. But, Greg is right. I mean, some of these new apartments, oh, look at this. Look how convenient it is. It's got a 24-hour doorman, and it's got covered parking, and it's got a fitness club and a pool, and it's $2,000 a month. And then, right, that kicks in the invariable debate, or inevitable. Use the right word, Paul. You're on the radio. The inevitable debate, well, do I rent or do I buy? Right? And some people, say, well, geez, for $2,000 a month, I can get a house and my mortgage would be $1,100 a month. But then you got to pay the taxes, so there's always, there's always give and take. A lot of Democrats up at the Capitol last couple of days. In fact, it was a big Zoom public hearing. They actually cut off the hearing earlier today, from what I understand. This thing went late into the night, I think, on people for and against some of these laws that would... some people say Bigfoot infringe. Other people say would be a watchdog over local zoning. So a lot of emotion about that. There are people who come out and pull no punches and say, hey, some of these suburban towns squarely aimed at you, Fairfield County, you zone to keep out people of color. Other people say nonsense. It's about maintaining property values and the character of a town. But one of these laws actually saying one of these proposed bills would forbid the use of character in local zoning. So, again, it's a classic zoning versus classic local, rather, versus state thing we have going on here in Hartford. They're trying to legislate that legislation, as Joe Lieberman once told me years ago when he was in the Senate. He said, Paul, it is, in fact, like being in the middle of making sausage. It's tasty at the end, but you don't want to watch it. Here's a guy who was into a lot of sausage making at the state capitol when he was there, but he got out, and he's free to talk right now. Former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso. is with us calling in to weigh in on this. Chris, how are you, sir?
Hey, Paul. You know, Paul, it's been 11 years since I've been out of the legislature, yeah. And these issues don't go away.
No, they don't. And, they don't.
Yeah. And it's frankly not just housing. It's policies that the state has inflicted on communities of land use, of property tax systems, of overdevelopment of the suburbs, underdevelopment of the cities, and what's happening now, the pressure is being put onto the suburbs. You know, you look at Monroe, for example. You don't have to come into a city to do any shopping.
Yeah.
Everything you need is there now. You have the Home Depot. You have everything you need is right there. You know, at one time, this issue goes back probably over 60 years, and it's in our Constitution, home rule. So the individual towns get to decide what they want to do.
Yeah.
The abolishing of the regional form of government. You know, you look at Bridgeport. Bridgeport is so tiny, it doesn't even meet any U.S. standards of a city. It's not even considered a small city based on its size. And yet it's in a region of 500,000 people. So, you know, you look at all those issues, and housing just becomes one more issue heaped onto this policy. And so poverty stays concentrated in cities.
Yeah.
But poverty also exists in Greenwich. It exists in Stamford. It exists in Norwalk. And the poverty stays concentrated. And after any situation, it has to percolate. And it's looking to move. You know, people are looking to move up and out.
Yes.
And so the pressure is put on the suburbs as a result. You know, the word racism, I'm not quick to call people racist. I think it's an overused word. And I think it just simplifies or makes very convenient an argument. There's larger issues. It's the property tax system that mm-hmm. that's retarding our cities. The suburbs are forced to build economic development along its borders to support themselves. There's an issue of management that goes on, but it's all policies that have been derived since, frankly, the 50s. You know, county form of government was abolished in Connecticut in the 50s.
Yeah.
And it was all based on corruption. Well, there wasn't corruption. It was based on fears, and it was based on, well, let's keep our communities the way they are. And it's like anything else. You're seeing now the rim towns that border the cities. They're experiencing many of the problems that the cities are experiencing. Mm. You know, you live in West Haven, I think it is. And
no, Wallingford. You know, Wallingford. I'm in Wallingford. Yeah.
Wallingford. So the problems that are in New Haven are spilling over into West Haven and mm-hmm. and the communities that surround it, just like Bridgeport. So housing becomes one more issue. I'll give you something people will not believe, but when I was a state rep,
yeah.
I represented Trumbull Gardens, which was public housing.
Okay.
There were people paying $1,500 a month.
That's amazing.
For rental.
That's amazing.
And it was subsidized, but it was based on their income. What, you know, some families were working,
yeah.
And so based on the income, they were paying high rental. So it's that squeeze and that push
mm-hmm.
that looks,
mm-hmm.
okay, how do we get out of where we are and how can we improve our housing and so forth? So, you know, unless we look at property tax system, unless we look at proper land use strategies, these issues are going to continue to press
yeah.
on communities like Wilton and others. You know,
absolutely. Chris, great to hear from you, Chris. Thank you.
You too.
Take care and
okay.
Call in anytime. We love the aspect and the perspective you give us. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso weighing in. And like Chris said, there are these problems, like I said earlier, also that have been just sticking around for decades and decades and decades, and you try to nip at them around the edges.